What is Peace Brain? Peace Brain is the synergistic connection between our mental and emotional bodies, blending the electrical power of the mind with the magnetic force of the heart. Listen and explore how to create unity worldwide as we blend science and metaphysics, open our hearts and minds to the possibilities of peace on Earth, and create the life we are each destined for. Featured guests range from angel communicators to zoologists and everything in between. Now here is your host, Dr. Gail Lash.
Welcome to the Peace Brain Show. I want to open with a quote. I'm really happy to have you all here today. And I have this marvelous quote that goes along with what we're going to be talking about today. And this comes from the 39th President of the United States, President Jimmy Carter, who also won the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize Award. And this is Dr. Gail Lash with you today with the Peace Brain Show. So here's the quote. It is good to realize that if love and peace can prevail on earth, and if we can teach our children to honor nature's gifts, the joys and beauties of the outdoors will be here forever. What a great sentiment. The quote has three parts, and I want to review this for just a minute. So we're first talking about if love and peace can prevail. That's really important. And of course, that's what the Peace Brain Show is about. And second, that we best teach our children to honor nature and her gifts. So how can we do that? Let's talk about that in just a minute. And third, that if these are in place, then the beauties of the outdoors will remain forever. And I don't know about you, but I love the outdoors. I grew up with the outdoors, and I think it's really important to get our children out into nature. And so how do we actually teach them to learn about nature, besides, of course, getting them outdoors in it, which is really important? We're going to today, in today's show, actually dive into these topics and how we can make love and peace prevail on Earth, and at the same time, teach our children about nature's gifts. So this show is really exciting today. This show is actually the beginning of a series that we'll be talking a lot about animals and about nature and animal spaces and how we can create these places of peace. Specifically, today we're going to be talking about accredited zoos and aquariums, and as well as nature parks and ecotourism destinations in this whole series. But today, we're going to be talking about zoos, and I have two special guests with me. One is Rebecca Green, who works with us at Tourism for Peace, and I'll introduce her in a minute, and Nevin Lash, who is a zoo designer and who is also my partner in crime and life, my husband. So let me introduce Rebecca. Rebecca is the marketing director of Tourism for Peace, and she is working with our graphics and our websites, our media copy, and our Scrivener research. And in her day job, in her real life job, which complements the Tourism for Peace, she works as associate director of creative services at Technology Associate of Georgia, which is TAG. And she designs and edits and publishes their Hub magazine, which is really exciting. She also develops logos, their marketing material, and manages their websites. And she is fluent in French and English. Welcome, Rebecca. Thanks for being on the show today.
Hi, Gail. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. I know you you really instigated the show, and we'll get into a lot of what your thoughts were about getting kids out into nature and teaching them about nature's gifts. And my other guest today is Nevin Lash, and he is co-owner and principal of URSA International, URSA, like the bear, International, which is a zoo design firm, and he's trained as a landscape architect. Nevin has worked with over 50 different projects in zoos and aquariums around the world in actually 12 different countries, and He's such as Italy and Jamaica and South Korea and Madagascar. He's very well versed in zoo design and what it takes to bring public and animals together and conservation messages. So welcome, Nevin. Thanks for being on the call today.
My pleasure. It's good to be on this call. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and looking forward to seeing what Rebecca brings to this. I really do like hearing the youth of today, being an old guy, and we're very cognizant of today's children and young adults, and want to make sure we stay current.
Absolutely. So let me ask Rebecca you a few questions first before we let you interview Nevin, basically, about what he does in zoo design. So first of all, I want to just ask you, what brought you to Tourism for Peace? What brought you to talk about education and peace and tourism and all of that?
Well, I think one of the things that really appealed to me about it was, first of all, educating people and interacting with young people, which is, I've generally always been involved in some aspect of education, usually through on the technology side. And, you know, just working with the Technology Association of Georgia, we deal with a lot of big corporations and, excuse me, we're very business-oriented. And I really liked the idea of sort of bringing into my life an organization that was really about peace and experiences for young people and growth in a more emotional and organic way, as opposed to just in a business sense.
I like that. That's beautiful. So in your mind, I know this is a big question, but what are the components, or how do you think we can achieve world peace?
That is a big question, but I think that two of the things that really stand out to me as necessary for achieving world peace are, first of all, education, and really allowing people to get to know people of other cultures, you know, experiencing one another and getting to know one another, not as abstract entities or names on the news, but real human beings.
And you are fluent in French. Have you traveled to French countries, French speaking countries?
I have. I lived in Paris for a year when I was in college. And I've just traveled. You know, I've traveled around the world, everywhere from Asia to, you know, a number of places in Europe. I haven't really seen very many places in South America. But so, yeah, I've done a fair amount of traveling. And French always comes in handy, even if it's just to help you understand Spanish better or something like that.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. So have you noticed then, have you gotten to know people from different cultures? And how is that changed your perspective on the world?
I definitely have. I think that one of the experiences that probably most changed my perspective from getting to know people of other cultures was a trip I took to Cambodia with my mother a couple years ago. And I just was floored by how incredibly kind and open the people there were. I just really fell in love with the Cambodian people and with the countryside there. And, you know, at the same time, it was really shocking to see that there was sort of a missing generation in there because of, you know, their violent history. And it really sort of changed my perspective on how sort of that whole area of the country and the long-lasting effects of some of our behavior, you know, world behaviors.
That opens the door to really talk about peace and the way that we resolve our differences, and that war can really have a lasting effect on generations, as you just pointed out, when war has ravaged a generation of the peoples in a particular country.
Right. And not only that, but also sort of our choices in terms of environmental impact and, you know, economic impact and world trade. It's pretty amazing how far I think peace goes beyond just the concept of war.
So back to Jimmy Carter's quote that when we can have love and peace prevail and teach our children about nature's gifts, we really can have the joy of the outdoors be here forever. And of course, that also extends to the joy of the cultural diversity of humans on this planet as well. So how, you know, in looking at today, we're going to be talking about animals and nature. How do you think, or what attracted you to think about nature parks? When I know you were listening to Nevin and I talk about the zoo design and the nature park design that we do in our business, Ursa International, is there something particular about animals for you that really makes a difference in your life or gets you excited about protecting the earth and creating peace on the earth?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I mean, there's sort of the obvious fact, which is, you know, I have a dog, and that brings me a tremendous amount of joy and a tremendous amount of fulfillment in seeing how the relationship, you know, between two species. And, you know, beyond that, just the fact that animals are so incredible and so intelligent in all these ways that I feel as a culture we aren't very good at giving them credit for. You know, and really seeing ourselves reflected in them. And I think that that's very important.
So have you been to the zoo in Atlanta?
I have. I grew up going there.
So zoos have been a part of your childhood.
Absolutely.
And does that, you know, zoos can be controversial and certainly were in the past. I know Zoo Atlanta, the way I got involved with it, and of course you, as growing up in Atlanta and going to the zoo, may remember this history as well, is that back in the 1980s, it was voted as one of the 10 worst zoos in the United States. And many times zoos in the past have gotten run down and are not good sanctuaries for animals. They're actually horrible places in many respects in the past. And so the city, I know, was voted, had a choice to either close it down or vote a bond referendum to uplift the zoo and really make it into a quality institution. And of course, that's what the city and the people in Atlanta, Georgia decided to do back in the mid or early 1980s. With that, the revitalization of the zoo really blossomed, and it became, I would say, one of the 10 best zoos in the United States. And did you see that history as you were growing up, or what was your impression go visiting the zoo over all those years?
Well, I think you raise an interesting point, and that is that, you know, I was a child of the 80s and early 90s, and as a child, I would have had no idea that it was one of the worst zoos. It was the only zoo I ever knew. And I didn't have any context in which to put it in. And in spite of the fact that it was apparently not a very good place for the animals, which is awful, you know, it still was I still loved going there, and I still loved seeing the animals. So I think that is kind of interesting in that, I think a child has such a different perspective on it than either an adult or someone who, you know, is sort of in the industry or more culturally aware of the context.
Hmm. That's an excellent point. I think when children can get close to animals and see them, particularly a variety of species that they wouldn't naturally see in their backyard, it does, with the eyes of a child, the wonder of a child, probably have a whole different effect than you're right, someone coming along later thinking about conservation and animal rights, which is obviously very important.
So, right. I think any child would agree if you told them. I just don't think they naturally are aware.
Right. So with that, I do want to talk about that to blend the wonder of a child and getting children, educating children towards nature's gifts and being able to see those species that they would never get a chance to see in their urban environment. And of course, most of the world lives in urban situations now these days, that it's really important to have zoos and aquariums. And I know that some people object to them, and the objections usually do come down to animals not living in great conditions. And certainly as a species normally existing in hundreds of hectares or, you know, many, many acres out in a natural setting, to put them in a confined area in captivity can seem like a really just a not a great thing to do, you know, that we're playing God from a human standpoint. And the reason I'm bringing all this is because these points are valid. And I know there are probably listeners, obviously, right here today, who have these viewpoints, and rightly so, that animals, it's interesting, animals in captivity tend to be kind of this, not only I would call them obviously ambassadors for their wild counterparts, but they are wild animals. And yet they are, in some ways, almost domesticated too. And so I'll clarify that, because obviously we have domesticated animals, like you just mentioned, Rebecca, your dog, and the cats, and the horses, and the pigs, and the animals we have on our farms. At the same time, animals in captivity these days are bred in captivity. By and large, they're not taken from the wild. So they only have known the life in a confined environment, in a zoo or an aquarium. And I don't want to spend too much of the show on this, but I think it's important for us to have a discussion about it, in that zoos and aquariums, as I said, have a certain standard to achieve. And there are accredited institutions. I know, Nevin, you can get into this in just a minute, but that in the United States, we have something called the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or AZZA, and you can go to AZA.org and look it up. This is an overarching organization that puts zoos and aquariums through accreditation. There we go, I got it. And they have to be accredited every 5 years and reaccredited. And that is a very long list of what has to be achieved, not only in standards for animal health and welfare, but also in conservation, mission, and education for the public. There is a huge list of points that has to be achieved for a zoo and aquarium to be accredited in the United States. And of course, worldwide, there are also associations of zoos and aquariums that really make a difference, that are also doing what we call in situ conservation, or conservation in the actual country of origin of many of these species, and working with the people on the ground, like in Cambodia you talked about, and other places around the world, to really help uplift the local people and have there be a harmony between the people and the animals in that particular place of origin of those species. But back to the ones in captivity, it's really important, and that's where zoo design comes in, to create a zoo that is based on animal welfare. And that really is the top priority of zoos now, all over the world, who are accredited. And certainly here in the United States. We just went to the annual conference. Every year there is an annual conference of the AZA held in September in different cities around the United States each year. And animal welfare was the topic of the day, and remains to be the pinnacle of zoo design and zoo operations around the world. So when we were talking about designing zoos, I know you were talking, you had some questions, Rebecca, about how you achieve that. What is involved in zoos? And it's complicated. There's a lot of things going on in putting a good zoo together, if you will, that not only takes that wonder of a child where the child can see that animal and be in that wonderful state, but also alleviates the fears and the concerns of adults who do have concerns about animals in captivity and making sure that the animals are in the best of health and in the best situation they can be, and really make it a win-win for everyone. So I want to open it up to where you, Rebecca, can talk to Nevin and ask some of these questions of a well-known, internationally known zoo designer of over 30 years. That Nevin, you have a great experience of working with clients from all over the world and all different species. And so I'm going to turn it over to you. Rebecca, go ahead and what were some of your thoughts when we were talking about zoo design?
Well, I think my first real question, Nevin, was if you could give me sort of a high-level overview of what goes into designing an exhibit at a zoo, because it's the kind of thing that I wouldn't even know where to start. So if it was me. So could you give us a little bit of a high-level overview of sort of how you go about designing a particular exhibit?
Sure, Rebecca. There's quite a bit of information that I could talk about, but I'm gonna stay at the high level. And you know, having grown up in Atlanta, you are the recipient of the work that I was doing for the first 10 years of zoo design, really from the mid '80s to the mid '90s, where Zoo Atlanta, which, as Gail mentioned, was a terrible place. And terrible meaning they found animal parts in different parts of the world. You know, they didn't take care and didn't respect the animals that were living there. You know, the facility was fine. It was beautiful, lovely trees and nice pathways. But it was managed by the sanitation department of the city. And how can they really understand what needed to be done? And it was at a time when a lot of other cities were waking up to the idea that, well, this is a little bit more complicated if we're really being scrutinized by the looks of our animals. This is just an evolutionary process that zoos have changed over time. And now, you know, in the early 80s, we were given the option of saying, okay, if it's not to be one of the worst zoos, how do we make it the best zoo? And of course, an organization gets developed that says, you know, we will manage the zoo. We're not going to do traffic lights. We're not going to do, you know, city pools. We're going to manage a zoo. And that brings in all these professionals that, you know, have been doing all this research and study in a variety of sectors. And all of a sudden, you've got careful planning and deliberation and creation of brand new exhibits. So at Zoo Atlanta, where they had a building that was called the Primate House, all the primates lived inside, and there they were in their tiled cages because it was easier to clean them if they were already in the bathroom. So it was a kind of a terrible place like that. And what we did was turned it inside out and put the animals outside. And of course, you can't put all the animals outside because before they were living in tiny little cages, and now they're outside under trees, and you know, we have to give them room, and everyone needs their own room and also family space and a variety of different needs. So at that point, you know, some of the species can't be exhibited anymore, and some of the priorities have to shift and only exhibit the ones that are perhaps endangered or threatened, so that those animals that are in a condition that, you know, is tenuous, let's focus on them and try to help them. And that's sort of the job of the zoo designer, is to say, okay, what's important in this situation? You know, what can we do the most good at? You know, what you have an opportunity. Here's a piece of land. You know, what can go here that will help the zoo better themselves and become a more respectable institution, an institution with higher goals than getting people in the gate and collecting their money. So it's that kind of a thing. Let's, what did that mean to you?
Well, that's interesting because I had never thought of zoo design as almost similar to curating, mm-hmm. just sort of choosing which animals are going to be on display. So when you've chosen which animals need to be on display, how do you make sure that they stay safe, that spectators stay safe, that they get along, you know, while still, you know, mimicking to some extent their natural habitat and right. sort of catering to their personal, you know, every different animal has its own intelligence, its own strengths, and it's surely its own different needs.
Yeah, and so it is a curatorial level. You're absolutely right. That's who says, hey, we need to do something about the tigers. We need to do something about the bears, whatever the situation is. And at that level, you know, they bring certain amount of information to the table and say, you know, I've seen a great exhibit that they were able to breed these animals and it was very natural looking and the social groups were well established and, you know, all these sort of key indicators of what makes a good exhibit. And they bring that to the zoo designer or they bring it to the director and say, we need some money. We need to put some money into our X. And so at that point, let's say it was gorillas, because that's a big piece of Zoo Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And so a budget was established. And then usually it's the hiring of a design firm that they can work with so to facilitate the creation of that exhibit. So that's a whole process into itself, but assume that that I've just been given the job. It's really a matter of researching that animal, knowing the most I can. And, you know, something like I said before, this like which animals would best be suited. Well, maybe the zoo comes together and says, you know, we're going to do gorillas, orangs, and chimps all in one exhibit. I think that would be really cool. So it's really the zoo designer to say, well, you know, that might not be the best thing to do because there's going to be some, you know, issues in a variety of ways. So there's a discussion. It's a back and forth discussion to say, are we, you know, is this the right exhibit to be done? Is it safe? Is it going to, you know, create a better environment for other captive animals? And, you know, that sort of discussion has to go on. But it becomes a commitment as a group, the curators, directors, and the zoo design team, and that might include other architects, other engineers. But at the very beginning, the zoo designer and the core client team goes through all those questions and gets a vision, determines a joint, you know, sort of a common vision for what the purpose of this exhibit will be. What's the mission? What are the goals? And really establish some big concepts, what we're going to do on this place. And it's a zoo designer concept to, you know, is the place big enough? What kind of orientation? What is it in next to? How does the story from one exhibit flow to the next exhibit and those pieces of the exhibit? So those are all the considerations that go into it.
One more question. Can you tell me what's your favorite exhibit? Can you tell me why?
Okay. Yeah, it's always a good question, but a harder one to answer. Only because each exhibit is, you know, the one I'm working on right now is usually the best exhibit, you know, I've ever worked on. Because it's really you know, that's the kind of energy you have to put into each project where, you know, the hopes and the dreams of the exhibit are what you've got to work with. In projects that I've built already, I can see all the flaws. I can see where the problems are and, you know, oh, I wish I was able to afford to do X, Y, or Z. And, you know, but on the exhibit that you work on currently, those are falling away and all you can see is the finished product and that it's working as you had hoped it to work. But besides that, there are some exhibits, and in Woodland Park in Seattle, there's a wonderful brown bear, grizzly bear exhibit that I worked on many years ago that even today is just phenomenal. You know, just phenomenal because it really gives the animals the peace and respect that they deserve, that they can be there without hurting themselves, without trying to get out. They seem to have a life. And that's what you're really hoping for, the best, for those animals that are in your exhibits to call that their home. And their home range has a certain size. And, you know, it's not the Great Plains or whatever, but it is a home. And I was reading something before that really sticks with me now with designing this new elephant exhibit that I'm working on. And that's making compartments. And you, in your home, you have all these different rooms. And animals think in the same way. They were saying that just because of the size of an exhibit doesn't mean it's any better than a smaller exhibit if the smaller exhibit has multiple compartments. And these are individual spaces within a bigger space. You know, in a tree, under a log, under a you know, a rocky place, or on top of a hill, or a view, or, you know, these are different compartments as you break down these little exhibits that we do. You know, it's an acre, might be a large one, and it might have 10 different little places that you give the animal a place to create some natural behaviors, to be who they are. Let a grizzly bear be a grizzly bear and dig up the gravel bar and look for food in there and be able to tear apart a log or, you know, any variety of things that you might imagine a grizzly bear wanting to do. So really that's our job, is to really put on the hat of the animal and say, well, what's your daily thing? What would you like to do? And it's usually based around food. And that's always interesting because there are these animals that are now communicating with their sign language, Coco out in California and Shantak here at Atlanta, the orangutan. And they're usually looking for food. That's the communication that they're. Coco is funny though. She wanted to know where her toilet was going to be. And because that was important to her. And she currently had one. If we're going to build her a new place, where's the toilet? And then, you know, that's one of the compartments. And these are these little places that you have to dream up a lot of these and make sure that they're in the concept all the way through the final drawings. And then that should create a better environment for the animals that will live in this place.
Wow. Yeah. That's really fascinating.
A little bit bigger than you were imagining. The zoo design world is an odd one. It really is. Well, what interests us is a lot different than someone doing an office park or a shopping mall, but we use the same tools. We use the same sort of landscape architecture and engineering disciplines. If you can't describe it on paper, then they can't build it. So it's that same level of detail.
Right. Well, can I ask you, it looks like we might have time for just one more question. Yeah, and I wanted to know, you know, given that you've designed zoos in places like Italy and Jamaica and South Korea, have you picked up on sort of cultural differences in relation to how they approach a zoo or animals in different countries?
It's interesting. The one experience I just flashed back on was in Uganda. And it was at the Entebbe Zoo, Uganda Wildlife Education Center. And this is the kind of a place you would imagine in the middle of Africa. Not a lot of resources, but a lot of heart. And I sat around a table with the education guy, the animal management head, the director, and the maintenance guy. And they were the same people that I see in every other zoo in the U.S. and in Europe. And everyone's got their role and their agenda. Even, you know, it could be a very, very different facility, but they have the same interests at mind. And usually, you know, the animal guy wants his best thing for his animals, and they're going to be making sure that nothing is compromised and that they are given, you know, their treatment. And the maintenance guy wants to know his products aren't going to fall apart after I'm gone. And, you know, what are the interests of the director? He wants the donors to come in and see a great final product that's worthy of additional funding. So it's phenomenal. But I think, you know, once you're in the zoo world, it doesn't really matter from location to location. There are nuance, of course, but there's, you know, these people are committed to creating a better place for animals, and that translates directly to their children. You know, that a place that can house animals in the most respectful manner and will then translate to a great experience for their kids growing up and seeing these animals for the first time and saying, wow, the world is very complicated. The world is very unique, and there's a lot going on here. So I think that answers your question.
It does. And in fact, it's kind of the answer I was hoping that you would give, because I, you know, I love the idea that it doesn't matter where in the world you are. These are still people who they all have the same thing and they care about animals. And you're right, showing them to their children.
Yeah, that's what it comes right back down to, everyone's individual needs. You know, it's to make sure that their children have a better life than they do, I think. And why do we work on zoos? Well, we want the animals to be around for our children. And, you know, we hear a lot about endangered animals and, you know, extinctions. And so it's a real topic. It's not theoretical. It's the real thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have a favorite animal?
No, I love them all.
Can you choose?
Let's see. Well, you know, they're all great. But I tend to go to the megafauna. You know, it's hard to love an ant, but it's easy to love an elephant. So,
yeah.
You know, but people seem to care for their insects as much as they do the mammals. But I take a whale over a fly any old day.
I have to say I agree with you on that one, but I do have a very healthy respect for the fly as well.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I do.
Thank you for
answering my questions. That was
sure. That was fun.
Eye-opening.
Thanks,
Rebecca, for those wonderful questions. I really appreciate it. And Nevin, for your answers. So let's talk a little bit. You know, I just want to comment on the megafauna. It made me think of bees. You know, there's a lot of concern about the pollination and bees and around the world. And so these insects, we don't tend to focus on them as much. And yet that's another story that zoos can tell and talk about the interconnectedness of the ecology of all life.
And it's amazing to think that, you know, if the bees were gone, this world would crumble. So from the smallest animals, you know, the largest animals fall. And so we do have to respect everything on this planet.
Absolutely. And of course, that gets into the climate change and all of what humans are doing to the world and sustainable development. So it's all connected. It really is. I want to talk for a minute about peace master plans. So I know I can talk about it, but I want you to introduce it, Nevin.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up in our very short conversation with Rebecca, but I might have gone on some other topic. But this is exciting, and this is something that finally Gail and I are working on together in a meaningful way that really suits her heart, bringing in peace to zoos. And it's true, it already exists, okay? We know on September 11th, Gail and I were in St. Louis, and you know, after hearing about what went on with the buildings, we felt we needed to go to a place of serenity, and we chose the zoo, and we chose the botanical gardens. And that's the kind of place that everyone thinks about when they want to go to a place of their inner self, and where everything is good and there's no bad in the world. And we want zoos to really embrace this topic and this subject. And we think they can, and we think they already do, but they really need to take it on and embrace it. And that's the idea of these peace master plans, is how can we create a common vision for peace and take a snapshot of the facility and say, how are we doing? And do we have a common vision that really goes to every department of the zoo, the veterinarian, to the curators, the groundskeeper, to the marketing person and director, and make sure their departments are really communicating the same vision. And this is a place for all families to come and know that they're welcome and they're protected and they're safe.
Exactly. It was really phenomenal the way when we had the tragedy in 2001 on 9/11, that all the zoos and aquariums opened up their doors for free to the public. It's a sanctuary. And that's one thing that we, with this now Peace Master Plan, we're going into a zoo or aquarium and saying, you know, how can you be known with the public as a place of peace? Because you already are. You know, the zoos obviously have a large biodiversity component. They have animals of all different species that we teach the public about, or that the public comes there to see and learn about, that are all getting along, you know, in a zoo. It's like the crayons in the box of different colors and different names all get along in the same box. Well, many different species get along in the zoo. And we point out the ecology and the connectedness of nature as the conservation message of zoos. We forget to talk about the humanity and the message of diversity of humanity being all one human race, if you will, on the planet that we were just talking about, that people are really basically the same all over the world. And it's about getting to know each other. And we can do that at zoos and aquariums, that all of humanity is welcome in a zoo. And shows up in a zoo from all different ethnicities and economic strata and age groups. And so why not start to talk about peace as that unity of diversity in a zoo and aquarium?
No, I think it resonates with everyone we've talked to. It's really great. These zoo directors, when we start talking about how their places could become more of a place of peace, they sit up and they really take notice, because that isn't where their eye has been. They're not seeing the connections and the linkages that we can, being outsiders, you know, being ones that can really see what their facilities are doing for their communities and their communities of international, you know, connections and how these animals relate to peoples in different parts of the world. It's just, it is a place where so much comes together, and there's a great opportunity for them to do even better than they're doing, becoming a better resource for these communities.
And what what we want to see is, or what we've suggested with people, and it has happened, is actually putting some kind of marker at a zoo, like a peace pole. Peace poles are from the United Nations World Peace Prayer Society, that say, may peace prevail on earth, in various languages. And it simply is a pole that you make a little garden around. It starts to create a marker that says, I am a place of peace. And so either a peace pole or a peace garden, I know zoos are talking about in the botanical gardens, making them into a peace area, a zen area, where you can either, you can feel that peacefulness. You can go for meditation. There's one zoo that put in wonderful musical instruments there. You can play these gongs and like a xylophone instrument outside. And it just creates this beautiful ambiance of, yes, I can start to have that peace inside of me and create peace in the world and realize the connectedness between all life that we each live. So we're also talking about putting these places of peace on a World Peace Trail map. And what this is connecting the dots, if you will, of creating what we're calling peace trails around the world. And, you know, you may have 5 in this area and 13 in this area. And actually, that's something that Atlanta in Atlanta, Georgia, in the United States has done, to where these different places that have a peace garden or peace pole or peace statue have gotten together, and they're on a map that you can go to AtlantaPeaceTrails.com and find out about it. So talk a little bit, Nevin, about the World Peace Trail map and how zoos can be a part of that.
Well, I think it's really exciting because the idea that we're all interconnected, of course, and is really breaks down as we go about our daily business. Here, you know, in the U.S., we're so insulated and we think of ourselves as, you know, sort of complete. But when we start relating to people in other parts of the world, all of a sudden that the world becomes a little bit more friendly and a little bit more unified. And we can embrace, you know, places that we've never even considered. You know, this, it's so nice to stretch ourselves beyond the U.S. And talk to a guy in Botswana about his elephants. You know, because there's, this is what makes the planet so amazing. And if we can create this World Peace Trail map, where all the places of peace are equally shown, we have friends everywhere, essentially, and each one of us has the opportunity to visit these places and know that you're getting, you know, you're at a place that's committed to world peace and is doing the best they can and doing their you know, community service and human rights and everything about their vision for the future can be sort of combined into that one concept of peace. And so with these poles and with this map, there is a really good chance that we can identify ourselves as a peaceful country and a peaceful world and move in that direction. So we could save our planet and our animals and our kids and not put our generations through war and, you know, just waste countless sums of money in the wrong direction, when the real true direction is peace on earth and a healthy ecosystem.
Absolutely. And we are putting together the website worldpeacetrails.com, and you too can add your place of peace onto that very soon. So I want to thank you both, Nevin and Rebecca, for being here today as our guests on our on the Peace Brain show. Are there any last comments that you have, Rebecca, that you want to add?
I do not have anything to add. This was a great conversation.
Thank you very much. Nevin, do you have anything else you would like to add?
Well, you know me. I could talk forever. But the conversation was wonderful. I wish we could do this more often. And I know you've got a busy schedule, but maybe we'll squeeze in another one and really get at the topics of you know, how a zoo can create more peaceful communities, you know, and that's just a whole new dialogue. We're just beginning to scratch the surface of. So thanks, Rebecca, for sharing all of your your brilliance.
Absolutely. Thanks for sharing your expertise. I'd love to go deeper into it on another episode as well.
Sounds great.
Sounds good. Sounds like a plan. Certainly, zoos and aquariums have a great possibility of influencing their, a great potential of influencing their community and starting that peace dialogue. So thank you both for being on the show. Now I want to, as we do end all of our shows, go into a peace brain meditation. And this is a chance where we can really connect with the peace inside of ourselves. And today, because animals have been our focus, I want to do a guided meditation to introduce you to your animal guide. You may already have one that you're working with, and yet there may be another that wants to come forth and be with you. So I suggest that you take a breath and just sit back in your chair or wherever you are, get comfortable, and begin to bring that peace inside of you and focus on your breath. Just take 3 deep breaths right now. And close your eyes. And I invite you to create what I call a grounding cord. And this is a grounding of your body into the earth. And the way I visualize it and suggest is visualizing a tree trunk or a beam of light coming out of your last vertebrae and going all the way down to the center of the planet, the center of Mother Earth. And allow it to flow out of you. Just allow all of the anxieties of the day or any questions you have, any energies that are not yours, to just flow down this grounding cord into the planet, into Mother Earth. She takes all of the energy that we don't need and recycles it into usable good energy. So allow with a breath it to flow all the way down and to be in present time, to really be in this present moment. And I like to widen my grounding cord to the width of my hips so it's really supporting me. And I feel connected to Mother Earth. So just feel that connection now that you have with Mother Earth. And I invite you to visualize a place in nature that really speaks to you. It could be a forest. It could be a river with rocks and running water, the sound of a babbling brook. It could be a beach with beautiful white sand and hot sun, with seagulls flying above. Whatever works for you, go out into nature and visualize that place. Smell the air, hear the sounds, feel the wind on your face, the coolness, the temperature, the warmth. Hear the animals calling and notice which animals are there around you. And begin to walk in that environment and feel the earth under your feet, the rustling of the leaves or the sand in your toes. You might dip your foot in a water. And as you walk along this path, notice the trees or the environment saying hello to you. And as you walk, an animal will call to you. Hear it. And then notice as it appears around the corner, it appears to you. And say hello to this animal. Thank it for coming today. This is the animal that wants to speak to you today, that wants to be one of your animal guides. Invite it to come close to you and find a place where you can sit or be next to it. Do not be afraid. This animal is here for you, for your health and well-being, and to help you find that peace within yourself, and to help create peace on earth. So take a moment, and perhaps even if the animal chooses, let you touch the animal. And ask it what message it has for you, and listen to its answer. And so now, what part of your life is this animal here to help you with? And receive that answer. And now walk with the animal down this path in this beautiful nature setting, and realize that this animal guide is always here for you and can always be called. Ask the animal what name you will call it by and receive your answer. Excellent. You have now had a communication with your animal guide. Now thank your animal and allow yourself to come back to this space where you're sitting in your room and know that that beautiful nature space with the animal waiting for you is always there for you to return to whenever you choose. And the animal will show up when you need it with the answers that you are looking for. So bring yourself back into your chair. Take a breath. Open your eyes when you're ready. All right, well, thank you very much for tuning in today to the Peace Brain Show and for getting to know your animal guide. Thank you for listening about zoos and aquariums and about how we can create peace on Earth through animals and nature parks and these places in our urban environments. And remember, if you would like to connect with me, Dr. Gail Latch, for a private Alchemy of Peace coaching session so that I can bring value to your life, or that if you'd like us to conduct a peace master plan for your company or organization, or so you can become known as a place of peace, please go to our website, tourismforpeace.com. tourismforpeace.com. Or you can email me at hello@peacebrain.org. So I'm happy to have you on the show today and look forward to being of service to you. And again, I want to thank my guests today, Ms. Rebecca Green and Mr. Nevin Latch, for opening the insights into zoo design and learning more about the world as it is. And now, please go forth and activate your peace brain and put your mark on the World Peace Trails map. Many blessings. Namaste.
Thank you for joining us on the Peace Brain Show. You can find us at tourismforpeace.com. Be sure to check out Dr. Gail's Alchemy of Peace coaching sessions, her Peace Master plans for your business or organization, and her upcoming book, Peace Brain 101. Tune in to BBS Radio Station 2 every other Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 p.m. Eastern for the Peace Brain Show and your next installment of wonder, inspiration, and practical peace.